Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a Damn Interesting Week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link. From the Wall Street Journal, we turn our attention to a global smuggling frenzy for an item worth twice as much as gold. Any guesses?
I mean, it's got to be something ridiculous, like belly button lint, or I don't know.
Wow, you got remarkably close.
No. What?
Because cattle gallstones are a prized ingredient in China's $60 billion traditional medicine industry. Oh. And as a result, gallstones have become the must-have item among underground traders and armed robbers in Brazil.
Wow. My dog passed a gallstone many, many years ago. We kept it, and it was the size of, I don't know, half the size of my fist. We could have been so wealthy.
Yeah.
I mean, hold on to your stones, folks, and also the stones of your animal brethren, because, cattle gallstones have become so valuable that traders are willing to pay as much as $5,800 an ounce.
Whoa.
And the reason these have become so valuable, especially lately, is that herbalists use them to treat strokes. And in China, they're grappling with a surge in hypertension, obesity, other conditions familiar in the affluent West. Well, these maladies are so widespread in China after half a century of rapid development and the changing diets that have come with it. Surging demand for gallstones has sparked a global treasure hunt across the world's top beef producing regions. We're talking about Australia, Texas, Brazil, as traders tried to get them to buyers in Hong Kong, Shanghai, and Beijing. Traditional medicine there is now a $60 billion a year industry. In part, China's government and state media have encouraged its use as a source of national pride. And Beijing has also promoted traditional medicine overseas to, I love how this was phrased, complement its worldwide infrastructure push.
Okay. So to make money.
Soft power branding, whatever. But boy, that was so diplomatically outlined. But what they're doing now is they're building traditional health clinics in countries like the United Arab Emirates, Spain, to encourage locals to start using traditional Chinese medicine. Now, this is an important note. Conservationists look at and point fingers at traditional Chinese medicine for an alarming rise in wildlife trafficking. Governments have struggled to contain the trade in rare animal parts. And while the harvesting of cattle gallstones itself raises few concerns among conservationists, the substance is often packaged with parts from endangered species. We're talking rhinoceros horns, pangolin scales, tiger's penises. And eventually all this stuff gets pressed down into what they call an angong pill. It costs about $200 US for a couple of pills. And this is something that a family would keep at home in their pill box for an emergency. Almost the way you have maybe like a home defibrillator, if anybody does. My father gave my mother a home defibrillator for Christmas one year.
What a sweet present.
It's kind of like,
I want you to stay alive. That's nice.
Yep. Yeah, I could not stop crying for all of those reasons. Anyway. But other purported benefits of cattle gallstones, lowering fever, treating infection, those don't have a lot of grounding in Western science. But some recent experimental studies have found that these angong pills can help buy a little bit of time in the treatment of strokes. So, for example, a recent study on rats at Hong Kong University found evidence that several ingredients in the pill protected the membrane that surrounds the brain, which is a way to potentially give stroke victims an extra 30 minutes to get to the hospital.
Right. Several ingredients, not all ingredients. And which one of those ingredients was the one?
Exactly.
That did it?
Yeah.
And why can't we just artificially chemically synthesize it? Because we can do that now, right?
Well, the thing is, I'm sure we can, but they're like, no, original is best. Like, this has to come from a real cow because otherwise it's not legit.
Right. The traditional Chinese medicine field, I think, does involve, energy. as mm-hmm. part of its system. It's a little bit more spiritual. And so having that animal connection may be a critical component, as well as contributing to over 70% of decline of animal diversity in the last 50 years. You know, whatever.
And that's the thing I've never really understood. It's like, I just don't believe that it's easier to go to a place where tigers live and hunt them and cut off their penises than it is to breed tigers in captivity solely for the purpose of. Like, I'm not saying it would be a great idea for them to do it. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying it seems like it would be better than driving this animal to extinction in the wild.
Yeah, but your overhead costs of sustaining life are so much greater than your right. overhead costs at a death-oriented profit margin.
Yeah, right. Sneaking in and stealing is easier than actually maintaining.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, all of this, again, is because of exacerbated wealth inequality, right? Like, folks are not going to be driven to mobbing farmers for gallstone. Well, anyway, that's me getting salty. All right, next link.
Next link.
It's from Ars Technica. Florida man, already off to a good start, mm-hmm. eats diet of butter, cheese, beef. Cholesterol oozes from his body.
No.
What could go wrong with eating an extremely high-fat diet of beef, cheese, and literal sticks of butter? Well, for one thing, your cholesterol levels could reach such stratospheric levels that lipids start oozing from your blood vessels, forming yellowish nodules on your skin. That was the disturbing case of a man in Florida who showed up at a Tampa hospital with a 3-week history of painless yellow eruptions on his palms and the soles of his feet and elbows. I'll say that again.
No, don't.
3 weeks until this man sought help.
I mean, listen, it was painless. He was like, this happens in Florida. You know, sometimes you ooze.
Painless, but a nuisance, because imagine cleaning up after. No.
Listen, anyone who's eating a stick of butter at a time, I don't think cleanliness is high on their agenda. Like, I'm sure he just thought, like, oh, it's more butter. I failed to wash my hands after eating a stick of butter.
They show a picture of his hands in the article, and it looks as if, like, Cheeto powder has been glued into every crease of his hand.
Okay.
So it's like a palm reader's dream. You can see every tiny crease. It's pretty gross.
I see death in your future. Near, very near.
Very close. So the man in his 40s told doctors that he had adopted a, quote, carnivore diet 8 months prior.
Mm-hmm.
His diet included 9 pounds of cheese.
No.
Sticks of butter. Daily hamburgers that had additional fat incorporated into them.
Oh my gosh.
And since taking on this brow-raising food plan, he claimed his weight dropped, his energy levels increased, and his, quote, mental clarity improved. Meanwhile, his cholesterol level exceeded 1,000 milligrams.
Whoa.
For context, the optimal total cholesterol is under 200.
Yeah,
240 is considered a high cholesterol level.
Oh my gosh.
They did note that prior to going on his, quote, fatty diet, his cholesterol had been between 210 to 300. So he was already high.
Yeah. He's just leaning into it. He said, let's go all the way.
The cardiologist diagnosed the man with xanthelasma. This starts with an X. A condition in which excess blood lipids ooze from blood vessels and form localized lipid deposits. The escaped lipids would normally be taken up by roaming white blood cells, but in the case of xanthelasma, the amount of lipids is too large, which turns into foam cells with the excess cholesterol leading to the visible deposits.
I mean, honestly, good for the human body. Like, mm-hmm. it has the ability to just start shoving things through your pores if that's what it's got to do to keep you alive. I'm impressed. I mean, I'm not impressed with the man, but I'm impressed with the human body.
Because usually it's seen apparently around the eye.
Oh,
so people that have this, it strikes people with lipid abnormalities. So this can happen to people outside of eating too much stuff.
Right, like Baron Harkonnen from Dune.
It's also thought that contagious blinking of an eye over a person's life can eventually weaken capillaries in the area. That also allows for the lipid seepage. So if you just have an eye that can't stop blinking, I guess it just weakens that.
Yeah, I mean, it could just be weak veins as opposed to too many fats in the vein. Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, maybe this is a carnivore kind of evolution, because if you are getting in some kind of tussle or wrestling match with someone you can't get a grip on, they may have the advantage.
Evolutionary slipperiness.
You know, it's just, that's a Florida thing. It's an evolution. We should congratulate him and welcome his new tribe.
So... apparently, with the people with this, they usually have heart risks, obviously, right, with the high cholesterol. And the case doesn't provide information on the man's outlook. But I think we all know it's grim and short.
It's up to him. He's thinking real clearly now, remember?
Right.
Well, better than before when he made the decision to go on the diet.
Right. Ken, we don't know where the starting point was with that. On that note, Next link.
All right. Well, I don't know if either of y'all are into genealogy, but this next article from The Guardian is about an ancestor we all share, and his name is Luca.
Oh.
But Luca's not an ape or a mammal or even technically a bacteria. Luca stands for Last Universal Common Ancestor, otherwise known as the progenitor of all life on Earth.
Oh.
I'm sorry. Are you just like really casually dropping? We have like source of life.
Well, yeah, basically. That's what they're talking about. Now, the thing is, we don't actually have any hard evidence of Luca. Luca's more of a concept, right?
Okay.
In that we know the evolutionary tree branches outward, and any two creatures on that tree can therefore be traced back to a common ancestor, even if you have to go a really long way to do it. And at the very base of our evolutionary tree is the split between bacteria, archaea, and eukarya, the latter being what evolved into everything that exists today that is not bacteria or archaea. Hmm. And they go into the difference between those two. We're not going to do it because it doesn't really matter. The important thing is that because we understand how genetic evolution works, we know there must have been at some point a single common ancestor to those three branches, and that organism is known as Luca. And up until recently, scientists have been guessing that Luca existed about 3.5 to 3.8 billion years ago. And that estimate made sense because it's right at the start, relatively speaking, of the Archean Eon, which is when Earth became slightly more habitable for life and our first bacterial evidence starts to show up in the fossil record. Prior to that is the Hadean Eon, named after the Greek god Hades because it is literally understood to be hell on Earth. The planet at that time had just suffered a massive cosmic collision that literally broke off a chunk of the planet to form the moon. It was absolutely covered in active volcanoes. The atmosphere was mostly carbon dioxide and methane. It was not a place that we thought anything, even the earliest single-celled organisms, could have lived. Until now. Because a new study has just come out that puts Luca somewhere in the realm of 4.2 billion years ago, right in the middle of the Hadean. And the way they came up with this number is they used something called molecular phylogenetics, which is basically a way of comparing the genomes of all living things and coming up with an average rate of mutation. That then gives us a, quote, molecular clock that we can use to count backward and basically say, okay, we know this creature has a liver and we know that a liver takes X amount of time to evolve. So we know we have to go back X number of years to find an ancestor that doesn't have a liver.
That's a lot of speculation.
It
wouldn't be like bursts in spots where there were accelerated and non-accelerated. Maybe that's taking in the average.
Yes. And the thing is, they do account for that. This is a much more complex model than I'm describing it as.
Okay.
And so because we now have more data than we used to, scientists are saying that given the structures we know ancient bacteria had, they would have required a certain amount of lead-up time to develop them, which means Luca definitely couldn't have shown up any later than 4.2 billion years ago. And in fact, our best guess is that Luca would have actually already been pretty advanced by that point. They say, for example, that before branching off into bacteria, archaea, and eukarya, Luca definitely had protein enzymes that it could use to feed itself by processing carbon dioxide and hydrogen in its environment. And that actually still leaves a lot of questions unanswered, because it's possible Luca could have gotten these molecules by hanging out at the surface of the ocean that covered most of the planet at that time. Or Luca could have gotten them from the deep hydrothermal vents at the bottom. We don't know where it lived yet. We just know that these are the earliest chemical processes it would have used to feed itself. because these are the internal structures we know it must have had.
Because it could have also come from an asteroid on another planet. Mm-hmm. That developed
stuff. Yeah, they're not even saying the origin of this thing. They're just saying we know this thing existed.
Right.
And that being said, we also know that life operates in cycles. So if we know that Luca was taking in one substance and excreting another, we can actually be fairly certain that there were other life forms doing the opposite. And again, like you're saying, it's all sort of conceptual. You know, we may eventually discover that these fellow organisms were actually what evolved into archaea and that we have to go back even further to find their true common ancestor. All they're really saying right now is that these internal structures existed a lot earlier than previously thought.
Wow, a lot earlier, too. Like, that's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And they aren't talking on the scale of billions of years, which is like so massive. You could be off by a couple hundred million.
Mm-hmm.
The researchers also say now that Luca had a kind of immune system to protect itself from viral infection, which means viruses were definitely around back then, too. And they say that actually makes perfect sense because the growing consensus is that viruses are an inevitable outcome of DNA replication. Like the way DNA works inherently creates this niche that viruses are always going to fill. And viruses do complicate the molecular clock because they can act as a vehicle for carrying a piece of DNA from one organism into another, which that's actually what CRISPR gene modification is based on, is a virus's ability to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And so that can speed up DNA evolution beyond just random mutation, but that is part of what they're including in this latest model to get the molecular clock as accurate as it can be.
Mm.
Most importantly, though, this latest study indicates that life isn't actually that hard, because if Luca and a bunch of other organisms were already this advanced during the Hadean, that means life can form almost anywhere under almost any conditions, including early Mars and even early Venus. You still need a lot of the correct conditions to get advanced life. But this study seems to imply that single-celled organisms, at least, could just be all over the galaxy. And personally, all I'm hoping is that when they do discover them, they keep giving them cute names.
Yeah.
Because I don't want Latin nonsense. I want Luca and Joey and Bartholomew. Like, I want
give me
cute
Pokemon
molecules.
Aliens or give me none at all.
Exactly. That's what I want. Next link.
Next link.
Well, that last article was a perfect exercise and illustration of the topic of this next article from Quantum Magazine. Concept cells help your brain build abstract information and build memories.
Hmm. I guess these are the cells that make concepts, not the cells are a concept.
Ooh, you're reading my mind here? Hold on.
Oh,
now.
No.
Yeah, this is going in a few places, so stick with us here. But you may have concept cells that fire for certain things or other things. The example that the article starts off with is, imagine you're on a first date, you're sipping a martini at the bar, you eat an olive, and you listen to your date tell you about their job at a bank. Now, your brain is processing the scene in part by breaking it down into concepts. Bar, martini, olive, bank. And deep in your brain, neurons known as concept cells are firing. So you may have concept cells that fire for martinis, but not for olives. Or maybe you've got one that fires for bars, or maybe even a specific bar if you've been there before.
Mm-hmm.
But when you are in that bar, you are starting to form concept cells for your date, whether you like them or not. And then the cells will fire when something reminds you of the person or that situation. Concept neurons fire for their concept no matter how it is presented. So whether you're seeing it in real life or a photo, whether it's something you're encountering in text or speech, it's an abstraction. And for decades, neuroscientists mocked the idea that the brain could have such intense selectivity down to the level of an individual neuron. It was kind of a joke until it wasn't. So in 1969, a really famous neuroscientist, Jerome Letvin, gave a lecture at MIT, and with a mocking tone, he told his students a story about a fictional neurosurgeon seeing a fictional patient who had a difficult relationship with his mother. To help, the neurosurgeon deleted a cell in his patient's brain that coded for his mother, thereby erasing all memories of her. Satisfied with his accomplishment, he continued his research by looking for grandmother cells. And ever since then, that's the name that stuck. And it was not something anybody took seriously at the time. A cell for every single person you've ever encountered? Ridiculous. Everybody poo-pooed the whole situation. Well, not everybody, because in the 1990s, a research group at UCLA, led by the neurosurgeon Itzhak Fried, developed a new kind of electrode that could look at the activity of individual neurons. an unprecedented level of resolution. So researchers, this is amazing how they proceeded with this study. They received consent from epilepsy patients, in part because epilepsy patients, these ones anyway, had electrodes already implanted into their brains as part of their medical treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So there was one scientist who was fiddling with the data. He, as a scientist, was showing them pictures of Richard Feynman, Albert Einstein. But a lot of his patients couldn't identify. These are sort of niche figures in the field. So
Right. When
he wasn't getting response, he switched to showing these people photos of more recognizable people, including Jennifer Aniston. This was early 2000s, but to his delight, he found a neuron that responded to the actor. So in a follow-up experiment, he showed patients 7 different pictures of Aniston, and he found the same neuron fired for all of the photos, but not for images of other actors or objects. Here, this gets wild too. So he wrote down Oprah Winfrey, and the same neurons that had fired for her picture also fired for her name in text, which meant the neurons were not responding to features of the picture, like brightness or color. They were context independent. So he knew his observation of one neuron firing didn't mean there was only one neuron for every concept. If that were true, the chance of finding it would be close to zero. And he believed that the brain must have many neurons for every concept, but how many, individualized, grouping, still unknown. Well, in 2005, his team published results in Nature, and finally the cells have a new nickname. Y'all, they were called Jennifer Aniston cells.
Oh, that's even worse than grandmother. Come on.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And at first, it was because of that long-running negative connotation around grandmother cells. But, you know, according to a main scientist, it was the hardest thing to get people to even accept the possibility. And nobody wanted to be accused of believing in these grandmother cells that were the butt of jokes. It was like Voyager. We got to get 7 of 9 on the show to give this idea any traction. So whether or not these are actually grandmother cells, a little bit of splitting hairs here. The cells were highly selective, firing only for Aniston or sometimes for closely related people like other friends, cast members.
Right, or the haircut.
Well, that's what we're starting to get into, because what this does is offer a concrete degree and mechanism of abstraction, which means everybody's got a different set of concepts and cells that encode them. Not everybody's seen Friends or follows celebrity culture, right? And for years after publishing all this work, Quiroga, the main scientist, who was not happy to be known as the Jennifer Aniston neuron guy, he tried so hard to get the term concept cells to stick. And it did not catch on until 2012, when finally he published a paper in Nature titled Concept Cells, the Building Blocks of Declarative Memory Functions.
I mean, it makes sense. Like, my thought process is when I see something and that reminds me of something else and that makes me think of something else, it's the train of thought where you're kind of going from one concept to the next. So I totally get all that. I get a little confused when they start talking about it's in one cell. Like, maybe, I guess I can imagine it like the one cell fires and that triggers a sensory cascade of like, oh, we remember how this felt and how it smelled and what emotions we had associated with it. But the concept cell is like the trigger for that whole cascade of things.
You're at exactly where researchers are. You may even want to join in on some of their random games, because they are currently debating how concept neurons fit in with other models of how the brain represents the external world. This is a new discovery. So now that you've read this article, you have probably formed concept cells that code for concept cells. That was at least the hope of the author. And I think they did a pretty good job with this.
And also, my Jennifer Aniston cells are always going to trigger when I think about concept cells. So
it's a sticky association. He's trying to move past it. But honestly, if that's what gets people interested.
Right.
Right. Next link.
Next link.
All right. This comes from Live Science. Contagious peeing may have deep evolutionary roots.
Contagious peeing.
You mean urination?
Oh. Mm-hmm. Like someone else is peeing and it makes you want to pee. Not
correct.
Like the pee. It's, okay. All right. Okay.
Right. Because people often go to the bathroom in groups. And according to new research, chimpanzees do the same, possibly to strengthen group social bonds.
Mm-hmm.
The study's co-author, Shinya Yamimoto, a wildlife researcher at Kyoto University, says, quote, "In humans, we all know that our decisions to urinate is influenced by social context that leads us to urinate simultaneously with others." I don't, but
we all know. I don't know.
And Our study with chimps clearly shows that they share some similarities in this phenomenon, suggesting the deep evolutionary origin of contagious urination. The team decided to study the behavior after noticing that a group of chimpanzees at a zoo tended to urinate at the same time and wondered whether it could be similar to contagious yawning, which has been observed in other primates and wolves.
Ooh.
The study found that this increased with physical proximity. So chimpanzees seeing another chimpanzee close to them peeing were more likely to follow suit. Social rank also influenced this behavior. Chimpanzees with lower dominance rank were more likely to pee when others were peeing. However, social closeness, measured by the time in close proximity and grooming with another chimpanzee, had no effect on the peeing phenomenon.
Okay.
Unlike with social yawning, which increases with socially closer pairs. So the behavior could exist to encourage, quote, state matching, where chimpanzees improve group cohesion by all being in a similar state. Or another possibility is that multiple chimpanzees urinating in a single location can deter or confuse predators by reducing the risk of being tracked through scattered urination odors.
Mm.
It's important to note, too, that this study was done with chimps in captivity, because no similar studies have been conducted with chimps in the wild yet. So if you're looking for some grant money, and you like watching chimps pee, there's a study out there for you.
Yeah. I mean, I would have to assume there's some vulnerability to it as well.
That's
yeah.
kind of what I was thinking as well.
Yeah. My dogs all pee kind of together, and they all kind of like wait for the first one to pee. And there's distinctly a like one of them is peeing and the other two are kind of looking out.
Yep.
Like there's more to it than just, oh, should we all do this now? Like I think peeing is a very vulnerable activity.
Oh, yeah. I mean, how does the saying go? Monkey pee, monkey poo?
Aw.
But behaviors like yawning, walking, rhythmic tapping, and even pupil size are known to be contagious. So they thought that maybe this was part of that as well. And they say studying... yeah.
I can 100% confirm the yawn, because number one, I know I'm a very contagious yawner, extremely. Literally every single time you've said the word yawn in this article, I have had to go away from my mic and yawn.
Your just concept so you know. Cells just for yawn are so triggering.
Oh my God, they're so strong. We used it literally when I was in second grade. My teacher put a poster on the wall of a lion yawning and she had to take it down because I could not stop all day. Anyway.
I mean, that's pretty much the end of it too, right? They're just saying that studying contagious urination could help scientists understand the origins of other social customs, or at least that's how they're justifying this study. Yeah. Next link.
All right. Well, next up from Live Science, we've got a cute little one called Why Do Bats Hang Upside Down to Sleep?
Aww.
And the main answer, not surprisingly, is evolution. But there's some interesting details within that. So according to Tara Hohoff, a bat biologist and the coordinator of the Illinois Bat Conservation Program, bats actually evolved flying before they evolved wings.
What?
Which it is to say, before they could fly, they could glide. And like, if you've ever seen a sugar glider, you can picture what we're talking about. So first, they were little mammals on the forest floor. Then they started climbing and jumping from trees. And as their limbs started to get stronger for better tree climbing and the webbing got thicker for better gliding, they eventually sort of crossed that line at some point where their limbs became what we would define as wings.
So cool. Sugar gliders are like one Pokemon level down from a bat.
Yeah, they're pre-bats, basically. But because they did evolve from jumping and gliding, they never had as much of a need for their wings to be strong enough to lift their body weight straight up off the ground like birds do. And many bats are indeed not strong enough to do this.
Huh.
So because they have to climb up high and then drop down into flight, it makes sense for them to sleep up high because then they can just get going as soon as they wake up. But that just gets them sleeping in the air. Why are they upside down? Well, that has to do with their leg structure. Like birds, they developed hollow bones to be better at flying, but because they spent a lot of their early generations clinging to trees, their tendons and leg joints morphed into a sort of backward structure from what we might expect, where tightening their leg muscles actually opens their talons and relaxing closes them.
Huh.
And you can think of it kind of like how if you lock your knee joints, you can stand with almost no effort, which it's really bad for your knees. Don't do that. But it's that same idea where you've sort of slotted yourself into place. And if you want to get out of that position, you have to kind of make a conscious effort to pull yourself loose again. So once a bat finds a place to grip for the night, they just relax and let their own body weight keep them attached all night long.
Huh.
Another thing that helps them stay upside down for long periods of time is their compact bodies and relatively large hearts. Because if a person hangs upside down too long, we start to suffer pretty quickly from blood pooling in our heads, right? And that's because our bodies are long and our heart just isn't designed to be pumping in that direction. But a bat's body is just a, you know, fat little round thing, and it's able to keep working no matter what direction they're facing. And finally, Hohoff points out, not all bats do sleep upside down. The disc-winged bat from Central and South America, for example, is a tiny little species that actually has little suction cups on their thumbs.
Stop.
And they use them to adhere directly to the backs of tree leaves at all sorts of angles. So, like, you can imagine how little they must weigh if they're hanging on tree leaves and they're doing fine. All of which means it's a really good thing that I don't live in Central or South America, because I don't know if I'd be able to stop myself from petting them, and I'd probably be getting rabies like 2 or 3 times a year. It'd be bad.
And I guess if you find a bat on the ground, try to get it up into a tree so it can fly away. Like, I had no idea they couldn't lift themselves off the ground.
Well, some species can. Okay. And also, definitely don't touch a bat if you find it on the ground. Because if it's out during the day, it probably is very sick and could give you rabies.
That was the pandemic before COVID, right?
Yes. No, we have a real problem with rabies in Austin because we have so many bats. I personally saved an acquaintance in school from getting what, you know, would have been a series of rabies shots even if the bat didn't have rabies, because you got to just get the shots if you're not sure.
Oh, those are no fun.
I was the one who told her. I was like, don't touch it. It's going to be sick. She's like, no, it's cute. And I put my shoe next to it and it bit my shoe. And she was like, woo! And so I was like, yeah, that's what I told you. But don't let that distract you. Bats are adorable. They're fine. Don't. They eat mosquitoes.
That's right.
All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include: Einstein probe detects puzzling cosmic explosion, developer creates infinite maze that traps AI training bots, and the outlaw tradition of noodling for catfish. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/DamnInteresting Week. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.